All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. It keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
Hello there, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm Hale, and with me as per usual is Brandon. And we kind of really thought about this episode in particular by expanding our kind of opening gimmick. We open our episodes with a quote or quandary, which is, you know, either an interesting quote or a kind of a question or small idea, a quandary that we really wanted to just get out there and briefly explore. And we decided to do a quote and quandary episode. So we've actually prepared a few quandaries and a few quotes, and we're just going to kind of bing back and forth with them. Just kind of enjoy some smaller snippets of philosophy.
I think we've noted several times where we'll say like, oh, you know, this could be like its own episode. And I know in the past, like we have started doing a show, we just run with it. Like the whole episode becomes something like that. They really are that pregnant in that way. So I'm looking forward to seeing what we brought to the table.
Keeping it kind of organic. So why don't we'll get right into our quotes and quandaries. It's going to be nonstop quotes and quandaries for the whole episode. But like you said, they often can easily turn into long conversations themselves. There's a lot there and in small pieces. My first quandary was something I was thinking about the other day. And I thought it's kind of a funny one to open with. I like to do a little bit of religious studies kind of stuff on the side, as I brought up before, some various kind of thinkers, content creators that I follow. It's just kind of casual interests. And a creator on YouTube by the name of Religion for Breakfast, I would recommend anyone checking out his stuff. He's pretty well known for kind of academic religious content on YouTube. Did an episode recently on fandoms, basically, and parasocial relationships within the context of fandoms, and how fandoms can have like a kind of religious aspect. They can almost look like religious belief. There's similarities there. He specifically talked about things like Disney adults and stuff like that. So these are people, for example, you know, who, you know, they collect all Disney memorabilia. Their lives are, you know, they first of all, they love Disney. But Disney is a centering cultural aspect of their life. It's become a major framework, much like a religion would be, in terms of how they understand themselves, what their interests are, their community, how they spend their time, right? And, you know, and how they frame the world effectively, right? Being a Disney adult is a relatively common thing for a company that purportedly makes kids content or children's content. But the key point here, as I just said, was company. And it immediately made me think of Mark Fisher, who we've talked about before, and the idea of capitalist realism. You know, the idea of capitalist realism being like what exists, what is real, capitalism being the primary thing. So basically, you know, like capitalism has become the fundamental aspect of our cultural and ontological existence. And it's the framework that we live everything kind of through. And so my quandary kind of became, these fandoms are basically always based around companies. Like that's the kind of key difference between them, or one of the key differences between them being a religion, right? It's either the love of some company, some organization, a pop star, a movie star, something like Star Wars, a kind of mixed media lore, you know, narrative, but ultimately they're all products. Is this an example of hyper capitalist realism where we're now taking the stage where a person's affiliation to an actual, like a corporate entity and corporate enterprise has become the central cultural and social mechanism of their self-understanding, right? Where now it's like, It's like, not only have we, are we immersed, just generally speaking, in the capitalist world, in this, you know, as Mark Fisher would kind of say, but it's almost as if these people are diving head first and doubly committing to that relationship and to that worldview. And I just thought, yeah, like, obviously it's kind of funny, the idea of like a hyper-capitalist realism. If your whole life revolves around effectively spending money for Disney, well, I mean, like, you're living a capitalistic consumer lifestyle par excellence, right? Like, you've almost committed, you have fully embodied the consumer as an almost spiritual mode of being.
Right at the beginning, when you talked about like the relationship between religion and fandom, I've thought about that in the opposite direction of thinking about religions as fandoms. So like, if you think about like the Imitation of Christ or something like that, and you think about the way that people like exemplify certain characters and, you know, fandoms or whatnot, the imitatio kind of looks like that. So I've always thought that's a bit funny. But your point is, it goes way beyond that. It goes into this idea that somehow the kind of function of religions are being sort of almost like displaced by the structures that these like media corporations have enabled. And since it's at the behest of profit, it's got this like hyper-capitalist realist aspect to it, where it's sort of like the integration of like a cosmic narrative into the consumerist machine in a way, because that's what it would have to be in order to be something like, you know, fandom as a religion, that it would have to have some like cosmological organizing principle. And in a certain way, when you center your identity around something, it almost does that, even if it doesn't offer up like an explicit, you know, chain of being or anything like that, because all it has to do is introduce an order in which you live, right? And if like going to Disneyland or like having your favorite characters or collecting memorabilia or something is like an activity that you find meaning in, and it's structured by this like largely ambient narrative of like the Disney franchise, then that seems to function. It seems like the phenomenon you're hitting on is present here, right?
Yeah, and I think you hit on it as well. It's like, what are the various functions of a religion? And I mean, there's the kind of like realist aspect of like understanding a religion in terms of like what it is, what that particular religion is. But then there's also the functionality of a religion, or at like any given religion, right? And I like how you kind of also brought up the aspect of narrative. Like, the biggest examples of this are obviously things like Disney, Star Wars, which I'm incidentally a fan of. That's partly what made me think of it, although I don't consider Star Wars like a key component of my identity. Just like biblical or other religious stories and narratives and, you know, moral truths and exercises and all this kind of stuff, these products have similar structures. Right? Like, they are, you know, in a galaxy far, far away, right? They're not, you know, like, us people don't necessarily actually technically believe that, you know, Donald Duck is real, but they may live in such a way where this character, which is also a product, is like a real thing, right? Like, functionally speaking, you know, their relationship with this product makes it a reality in their own life, in the same way that someone's relationship with, you know, a religious figure might be. I mean, obviously, there's going to be like significant differences, and there could be huge arguments around the spirituality of it. But I think that's where like the aspect of the hyper-real capitalistic aspect comes in, where it's like, okay, we're now even subsuming like the spiritual, the, you know, into, like, we're taking what we already see as like a functional behavior and structures, and shifting it over into, you know, a relationship with a corporate entity.
Isn't there already kind of like a new religious move, like a Jedi new religious movement? I've also thought that too. Like, one of the things that made me think of like religion as like an interpretable framework of religion through fandom is what I see happen in fandoms kind of looks like theology to me. Like, people will talk about what they call their head canons. So, like, their theories about a particular franchise and how they interpret it or whatever, trying to make sense of things. It looks like looks a lot like theological discussions of trying to, like, and like hermeneutics and trying to reconcile contradictions and like make sense of certain things. It preoccupies you in the same way that those theological discussions go about. Like, it's something to discuss with people who have the interest in this and trying to make sense of it, right? There's almost like a kind of incentive for corporations to not step in and like clear things up. In the Zelda video games, they don't really have like a linear chronology to them. So the question of like the order of the video games doesn't really make sense. But Nintendo put out a book where they tried to create like a timeline of how it works. It's worse than like anyone else's headcanon about how the games work. So it's like, why did you even do that? Like, just don't say anything. Just leave it. That's to be filled in and enjoyed by the gamer who enjoys Zelda. Yeah, so you started with a quandary. Maybe I'll start with a quandary too. So I should say that when I was preparing my quandaries, I mostly went to texts to get them. So they look something like quotes. I'll be quoting to start my quandaries, but they are quandaries because they're kind of problems with particular things or just like, you know, interesting questions that I wanted to raise or things that I noticed, right? Dichotomies I'm noticing. So my first quandary actually is quoting from Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. And it is kind of something that I have noticed in the past, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it. It's a little surprise. I know in the past I have said that Marcus Aurelius's Meditations is not my favorite text, but I still think that Stoicism is like an interesting movement. It's just not one that I like draw from in like a core way. But in any case, I'll start with this quote from Marcus Aurelius. He says, "How ridiculous and how much of a stranger in the universe is he who is surprised at anything which happens in his life?" So basically what Marcus Aurelius is saying here is, don't be surprised. Don't be shocked. The universe is completely intelligible. We live in an intelligible universe where things are kind of on rails. The universe is the logos, essentially. So once you are living in accord with nature and you understand the logos, nothing should be a surprise to you, right? Now, this is really interesting for me because it is in Plato and Aristotle where we get the idea that really philosophy actually starts in Thalmudzain, right? Wonder, in surprise, in shock. A lot of theorizing in like, especially like 20th century and like contemporary philosophy and phenomenology especially, is this idea that philosophy doesn't happen until we sort of bump up against things or we have problems, right? So there's this interesting contrast, and it doesn't take very long to get to there, right? I mean, the gap between Aristotle and Marcus Aurelius is quite brief. The fact that we move from a conception of philosophy that starts with wonder and curiosity and wondering how it is that the world kind of works the way it does, even if it does have intelligibility, that the philosopher is the person who turns to the world and wonders how it works, to Marcus Aurelius saying, hey, if you're scratching your head, you're a chump. Like, what are you doing? You're not a real philosopher. So that's kind of my quandary in that sense, is like, How is it that you can have two conceptions of philosophy that seem to depart from or have like such different attitudes towards what is apparently its like initial conceiving moment? They are two viable forms of philosophy. Like, Stoicism is a viable approach to living. It's a form of life that you can live. You can try and live in accord with virtue, which is to just live in accord with the logos, right? That's something that people do all the time. There are Stoics. But then there are also philosophers who are turning over questions and are encountering things in wonder. And that also inspires an enormous amount of philosophy.
It's more of a practice, almost like leading more into like a theology, in terms of like, you know, what it's going to serve you and what it's going to do. And like, you know, I really think, like, I really like that quote from Marcus Aurelius, but at the same time, it's also like a classic philosophical quote that to me is like, it's kind of a tautology. Like, it's just sort of like, yeah, what is, which ultimately is in some sense a pretty like fair observation. It's, you know, the most fundamental aspects of like things that will happen to you in life are only ever going to be the things that can happen in life. They're just going to happen. You're just going to have to deal with them. But it's ultimately more of a practice. And what I think, like, you know, when I think about, like, I've been reading some Aristotle and stuff again recently, I get back to the sense of like wonder, where there's more this emphasis on trying to like understand the world around you, right? This is investigation. Like, we often talk about like the questioner or whatever, right? Whereas I always see Stoics as more of like, it's more about acceptance, right? Like, you know, people make comparisons to Buddhism and stuff all the time with Stoicism. And I think that's, you know, not without merit. That again, it's like, it's very tied up with this sort of like functional coping process of like, and Marcus Aurelius, obviously, like, I'm sure most of our listeners know, like, was a Roman emperor who almost certainly led a very stressful and complicated life. And was, you know, effectively managing in the world's most complicated ancient bureaucracy, right? Like, you know, like, so it's, you've got to have, you don't have a time or space to like try and like understand the nature of reality, right? Because like your reality is so like front and center that you just have to be able to deal with that, right? Like, going beyond, like, what's the point in going beyond?
Yeah.
Right? And you don't even have the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's good that you kind of bring it back to the idea of like Stoicism as a particular practice, right? Because one of the things that I was going to draw on here was to really kind of actually vouch for Marcus Aurelius in this moment, that there really is something to philosophy, I think, that produces someone who can cope with and deal with things on a heel turn, you know, in the moment. They don't lose their head about things. When exigencies emerge, they're not, you know, they don't have their hands in their head in their hands about it. They just kind of deal with it. And that's kind of the attitude that I think that Marcus Aurelius is going for there, that you have to carry yourself through your life. And when things emerge, you don't dwell on them. You simply deal with them, right? When something comes up, you will be shocked by it. You will be surprised by it, but you won't fall into anything from that. You will just deal with it as something comes up. So I think that, and that's kind of the quandary for me, right? Is there does seem to be these two poles to the way that philosophy deals with surprise and wonder and dealing with the emergencies of things, that on the one hand, struggling with them can be inspiring, but on the other hand, my experience does tell me that a competent, good human being, one who is not just, you know, a moral person, but who is a person who is good at being a human being, is able to handle things. And it's even interesting because I feel like we find that a little bit in Aristotle's conception of the phronemos, right? Of the virtuous, of the practically virtuous person. They simply know what to do in a given moment.
Aristotle only gets there from, you know, obviously like a deep metaphysical background, although I guess you don't have to like, you know, read the metaphysics to understand the ethics. But ultimately, like, you know, I do think, like, having read both Stoicism and, say, the Nicomachean Ethics, if you were to ask me, like, what is a more realistic idea of what ethics is, of what living a good life looks like, of, like, what a good person is, then I would say Aristotle is certainly more on the mark, right? Because it's a system that has, like, spent more time trying to understand what life is. You know, it's a system, what life is like, what social life is like, what political life is like, and then looking for good examples of that, rather than a system that's very like inward looking in terms of like, how do you specifically, the reader, deal with like, you know, the troubles and struggles of your day to day. And in that sense, like, you know, basically blocking everything out and just being like, you know, I'll, you know, I can deal with whatever comes to me is like a pretty like easy tool to use. It's like very, it's again, like we said, it's very functional, but it, I don't think it's actually necessarily super reflective of how most good, like flourishing people live.
Yeah. There is always kind of something like, there is something impoverishing, it seems. There seems to be something kind of impoverishing about the detachment that Stoicism demands, right? I mean, there is, we have an idea of a person who has a flourishing life, and that is the person who has and meets and can satisfy particular kinds of attachments, right? They're actually pulled by life in certain ways. It's not just that they're completely like autonomous, kind of going through.
Well, I think there's something about, like, specifically in Nicomachean Ethics, like I always found Aristotle's, which isn't really surprising, like ethical conceptions to be very like organic, right? Like they, you know, if something bad happens to you, it makes sense that you're upset, right? Like you, like it's okay. Like, you know, within his conception, like, you know, if a tragedy occurs, like it's okay to be deeply disturbed, right? Like that is a normal human reaction and well within like your normal rights of like behavior or expectations or whatever. Whereas like Stoicism always feels like it's like a swimming up river kind of exercise, right? Like you're like you're really trying to like before anything even happens, you're like, okay, bad stuff will happen. So instead of like dealing with it as it comes, I'm going to like prepare myself ahead of time to be a kind of like detached person. So when bad stuff happens, I'll be less affected. There is almost certainly some just straight up cultural and textual and like information exchange going on like at that time between like the Indo-Chinese world and like the Roman Empire. So like the fact that these ideas are similar, like is not, I'm like, yeah, like there's clearly influences going on. And I can't remember the top off the top of my head, but I know that there are like Neoplatonists and people like that who were like, it's like complete, like were obviously affiliated with like Buddhist thought and stuff like that at their time, or Hindu thought or whatever. And so like these, yeah, like they're clearly like distant, at the very least distant cousins.
It would be really cool to trace that out. But I bring that up just to say too, that like, I know that in Stoicism and especially in like contemporary Stoicism and even like contemporary like pop Buddhism, you know, mindfulness and stuff like that, there's a lot of emphasis on kind of like detaching from pains or like detaching from things in order to alleviate suffering and to get away from pain and whatnot. But if you actually look at like Buddhism and you really like dig down to the implications of what Stoicism is telling you, you also have to detach from pleasures, right? Because it's not it's not just that you want good stuff. It's that the whole point of it is to remove those attachments per se, right? Like if you get attached to if you get hurt and you kind of let it sink into you, that's bad because that's an attachment. But if you have something good and you let that become like a desire, that's also an attachment, right? That links you to the external world, and now you're no longer autonomous. So it's not even necessary. Like, we get a lot of this in Marcus Aurelius because he's, you know, subject to a lot of, like, stress and whatnot. He's trying to detach himself from a lot of suffering. But he also, too, does talk about, like, detaching from pleasures and whatnot. He has this exercise of, like, image, looking at an image as like a disgusting thing, right? And he'll even imagine like eating good food as like sloshing around in his throat, and then it goes into his stomach and it's making all these sounds and it's gross. So he's trying to like detach from pleasures as well, right? Because it's attachment itself that's the enemy here.
I'm going to jump in with a quote now, speaking of Marcus Aurelius and leading great empires. No. We're gonna switch over to ancient China now, though. That the Hans Fei, who was one of the founders of the kind of legalist, you know, the school of political philosophy in China, kind of one of the big ancient Chinese thinkers, who was around during the Warring States period. So I think a little bit before Marcus Aurelius' time, but not by a huge amount in the historical timeline. But Henspade said, this is a quote from him, he gave a definition of laws, which I thought was interesting. Henspade said, laws are the means of prohibiting error and ruling out selfish motives. Strict penalties are the means of enforcing orders and disciplining inferiors. If law does not command respect, then all the ruler's actions will be endangered. If penalties are not enforced, then evil will never be surmounted. One should use laws to govern the state, disposing of all matters on their basis alone. I picked this quote in particular because it's important to have like a very brief like historical background. Henspade was like writing during the Warring States period, when basically like China was in a gigantic multi-sided civil war and it was super chaotic and backstabbing and really important period in Chinese history, especially during Chinese thought, but like just super chaotic and violent. And I like this quote because it really just breaks down law at that time in that world to, okay, we need super reliable, strong structures to keep society stable, right? Like, and it specifically the laws of and ruling out selfish motives. Henspade was like really, really specific because like corruption was like a really big issue. So really specifically that like laws are there for to create a state that is sort of like, you know, above, like, you know, super any, you know, in any individual citizen, right? And that state structure is necessary for, you know, there to not be a chaos, just absolutely chaotic, you know, kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, you know, all for one sort of situation. Yeah, exactly. And that's what I was having an anarchic situation. It was, and it just reminded me, it's very like Hobbesian in his kind of, like, I was basically the same. It's basically like, look, you need to have laws, and they need to be really strictly enforced, because if you don't have laws and a like legal structure, then it's just going to be absolute chaos. And yeah, so I just thought that was an interesting quote because it was honestly very reflective of like what Hobbes said, you know, 1600 or so years later. But I also think gets to like the core of like what the legal system is a little bit about, right? The legal system is supposed to provide like some semblance of structure. Obviously, there's all sorts of, gets far more complex than that, and how that legal system functions and what its basis is on, all that kind of stuff, you know. But at the end of the day, when you have someone who's living through like Armageddon like scenarios, they just want rules that everyone is going to follow so that it's not so chaotic and like crazy all the time.
Yeah, it's also interesting the parallel with Hobbes as well, given not only the, and I should say too, the Chinese historical sort of account is important there because it does explain why Henspei would want to introduce kind of real politics stability. And it's interesting because that's also the case with Hobbes too, right? Hobbes is writing in a time in England where there's a lot, yeah, during the English Civil War, where a similar situation, not as like multi-sided as far as like borders and factions going, but nonetheless, you're in a situation of political and like social and governmental instability where the foundations of the expectations of social, governmental and political life are threatened, right? So people seem to, this seems to be a recurring theme in East and in West, that when there is instability, political instability, people assert a framework for a kind of realistic, legalistic, in this case, it's literally what the Chinese school is, a legalistic form of government. The other thing that's interesting, too, is that in the Chinese context, you do also, that is also sort of the situation that Confucius is emerging from, right? But he responds by saying that we need to introduce a new kind of class of people who just won't be selfish, right? We need to develop the junsu, the noble person who has a certain kind of character, right?
The sort of the promoting of a virtuous community and virtuous individuals, right? Which Hansfei is like is basically says is just like not a thing. Like you're just you're,
yeah, exactly.
You know, you're just kind of head in the clouds. You know?
Yeah, they're both trying to respond to the same problem, which is selfishness in government, which is the idea that people aren't using government for the